Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Mike Murphy, together with Susan Franzen. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mike. I'm happy to be on Local Talk with you, and I'm excited to tell you and our listeners about the special guests we'll have with us today, because libraries have played such an important role in helping families and individuals deal with the isolation of COVID-19, I thought we'd talk with a representative sampling of the outstanding people who manage programs for our libraries in our area. In the latter half of the program, we'll find out about a very special book compiled for the 100th anniversary celebration of the Iowa State Parks.
Well, I know you have three librarians here because we've already brought them into the Zoom room.
Yeah, yes. Welcome to Colleen Taylor, who's been library director of the Bertha Bartlett Library in Story City for 13 years, and to Shanna Speer from the Nevada Public Library. Shanna grew up in Nevada and graduated from Nevada High School before she went off to college in Truman State University in Missouri, and after her undergraduate degree, she headed to Florida State for graduate degrees in library science and music therapy. And according to the newspaper article by Marlis Barker that I read, you returned to your dream library.
The Nevada Public Library you knew growing up.
I know the feeling, the love of the first library. And finally,
Zach Speer
Has been a children's librarian for over 10 years at the Erickson Public Library in Boone. Speer believes that storytelling provides power to elevate the learning experience. In 2017, his library was one out of 78 public libraries in the nation to receive the NASA My Library Program grant, allowing his community interactive opportunities to learn about NASA. That sounds pretty literally far out. I've actually condensed the achievements of our guests in order to feature the opportunities that people in Central Iowa have with their libraries. I'll begin with Colleen Taylor, who was a presenter for the Public Library Association on a Zoom webinar in late April 2020, presenting the process she envisioned for a phased-in reopening plan, which we're all going through right now, to approximately 1,500 librarians from around the world. What was that like? I think you had even a little trouble with your Zoom room with 1,500 librarians. Is that right?
Actually, I was amazed. It was pretty, it was not too bad. And obviously, it was in the depth of nobody was going in to our library anyway. We had one person that was answering phones, and so the rest of us stayed home. So, no, actually, we went and had pretty successful. I watched a lot of people signing in from all over the world. So that told me that was pretty successful. So I was shocked at how far away people were looking at this. But I think what the I have no idea if people had a lot of issues, but it didn't seem like they did. But the presenter, the coordination came out of Chicago, and I know that one of the other people involved was in Colorado, so they were all in different states. We were all in different states, all the presenters and all the people involved. So it went pretty well.
And what were some of the recommendations that came out of that?
Well, unfortunately, I had signed up for this webinar, and I didn't expect to be a presenter, so it was because everyone was in the throes of, oh my gosh, we can't open our library services right now, and it felt like it was critically important for people to have access to some information, some resources, especially with all the parents that were going to have to deal with homeschooling their kids. So we were in a panic. So we were, as soon as we got told we had to lock down, I started trying to make plans for reopening. I mean, it was immediate. So I put together a plan pretty early on so I could take it to board members, city council members, to talk through some ideas about how to reopen. The issues that came up on the outside of it, I think most libraries agreed that a gradual reopening made sense, just the way we kind of gradually shut down which we immediately started having. Actually, we shut down pretty darn fast. We didn't have much time to do much planning. So the minute I got sent home, the key part was getting your technology in order so that you could communicate with people, getting your Zoom on your computers, getting a laptop. And a lot of people didn't have those things available to them. I don't know why, but I even had plenty of Clorox wipes in stock, Lysol in stock. I had everything in stock that was needed for PPE. So we were prepared without knowing we were preparing for this. so that helped. I think as far as other suggestions that came out of it, the most important thing was safety. Everyone was very concerned about their employees bringing staff back into their libraries and how to keep them safe from the public. And the majority of the public are very conscientious and very careful about their library materials, but there's always one bad apple. It's in every group of people in the world. So the concerns that have been raised by our city council, our board members, our staff, I wanted to make sure we could erase as many problems or questions as possible. So our procedure is pretty close to what, if you go into a hospital, our recommendations are pretty close to what they're having to do in the hospital. We clean after every person walks in the building now. And wherever they go, we go behind them and then touch any flat surfaces. Their books don't go back on the shelf. We sanitize them before we reshelve them. We've gone to extremes. And I think that's what everybody feels like they're doing, is they're going to the extremes to make sure people are going to be safe. And that I would actually say, what I saw in that webinar is people saying, what do I need to get and where do I buy it? And that was, at that time, it was almost impossible to get some of the things that were needed.
Wow. And you're already faced, you started your letting people into the library for by appointment, what, on the 8th of June?
Yeah. We could have gone earlier, but there was a lot of, there was an abundance of caution. And, you know, it's at least open. And we literally had people crying, because they didn't have anything to read in their homes. Our population is vast. It is, the people that use our library are from every demographic. They're every age group. Some of our elderly people that use our library, we were their total social outlet, and not even being able to get materials to read was just heartbreaking for some of them. So, you know, we started doing curbside delivery, I think the 1st of June. No, maybe it must have been in May. We had only gone to curbside for a while, and that's very labor intensive, but it was better than nothing. We were able to get things to people. So, and then we went to, we started doing the different, I did my first book clubs. We did everything by Zoom. We did my book club by Zoom. We're doing our preschool story time with Zoom. And we started all of that in I'm losing track of time, in May, I think. So it's been, time has really gotten warped on for all of us. We don't know how long things have been going on, but we've added what we can for services as quickly as we can. We had curbside people that could use our Wi-Fi. We increased our Wi-Fi quite dramatically. So we
and actually the man who used to be my co-host, but he can't Zoom in, and he doesn't have a computer at home. His computer access was totally through the library. And the irony is that so many of the programs provided in this period by the libraries and everybody else were computer-based. So if you didn't have a computer, you were really isolated, because you can't come into the library for a Zoom meeting.
And I was told that they are sold out. I have just a PC on order, and it's another month before delivery for us. And so people that didn't already have them weren't able to get them. So it really shut a lot of people out of access to digital. You know, we talked a lot about our digital downloadable resources that could be used. But if you didn't have that those things in place, you were just out of luck. And that was horrifying.
The complexities of opening, I think, are probably everybody's problem, too. But, Shauna, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, hi. I was particularly interested in the book club that you have.
We actually have four book clubs at the Nevada Library. And so during this time, we've only kept with one via Zoom. So we have one where we've read a couple of public domain books. So we read, I think, My Man Jeeves and The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes as a set and talked about those books together for 1 month. We talked about, I forget what the first one was that we did. And then this month we'll be doing Pride and Prejudice. The other book club that we've been doing is a Bring Your Own book club, so that people can kind of have an opportunity to talk with others about books still. So it's not like we're all reading the same book. It's more, what have you been reading? Please tell us about what you've been reading and if you've enjoyed it. And, you know, they've gotten good recommendations from the other participants because they just don't get that right now necessarily.
Oh, well, I remember what intrigued me was the quarantine book club, because you not only had copies of the book online that you could get, but you had audiobooks. So you could listen to the book if you were, for any reason, not able to read it or just wanted to listen to it. And I thought that was a nice idea to have the combination. And of course, not very many books you could do that. Now, you mentioned the public domain problem. Is that because you were discussing it over the air that you had to have books in the public domain?
No, it wasn't because of that. It was actually because the availability of books, because we were doing it in a format that was online and, you know, we were doing curbside occasionally, but not throughout the entire time that we've been closed. So we couldn't get the books to people. So we needed to choose items that they potentially already had just by the age of the books and the classic titles, but also because when they're in the public domain, the service that we have for digital items only has one user at a time who will be able to have that item. And by choosing the public domain ones, people can access it in multiple ways through. My brain is going everywhere. So through Bridges, one person can have one item at a time, but they are able to have multiple people check out the same public domain titles at the same time.
One of the things that I noticed when I was doing background for this program was that Bridges was at least in all three of your libraries, as well as in Ames. Is that provided by the State Library Association, or do you all have to sign up individually?
We do have to sign up for it, but the State Library is able to give us a discount because the whole state, almost all the libraries are able to participate. They're able to get us a discount on the items, but that also means that we are sharing it with everyone in the state. So that's why sometimes when people access Bridges, then there are a hold list that are very long, because you're not going up with just your community necessarily, but it could be someone from Decorah or Atlantic, other places in the state.
I see. That's how that works. Well, are there any things that you'd like to talk about, especially that you've faced in Nevada, or that you'd like to talk about as you come out of seclusion?
I think one of the things that we're really excited about is how we've revamped our summer program for the way that things are happening. We have in the past typically had a program where the kids will read, you know, a certain amount, and they'll mark it off on a sheet and they'll come in and get prizes. But this year, we wanted to encourage them to do more than just read. And so we are doing a summer quest is what we're calling it. And we've put together all sorts of different experiences that people can go out and do. So, you know, you could go on a nature walk and take a picture of butterfly that you see. That's one that our children's librarian did the other day and posted on Facebook. And so he's working on the nature quest. And then there are ones where to knit or going out and finding different tree leaves and making a color drawing of them, or finding out what type of trees they are. So for all of the different things that you do on this quest, you get experience points and you can level up your character. So when you have leveled up your character, then you'll get a little, what is it, like a gift card to one of the local places. We're going to purchase gift cards to the local businesses to help support them during this time. And then at the end, we've got a guy, a local guy who was teaching our drawing, which was really awesome. And he's going to provide some commissioned artwork as our grand prizes that people can get. So we're pretty excited about the different thing that we're doing.
Well, that is sounds like it's a community-wide program.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we're trying to get everyone involved. It's for all ages. It's not just for kids. We want adults to be involved too. So we've got some quests that are more for adults, kind of one that's like a make your own cocktail, you know, come up with your own name and the ingredients, put it together and stuff like that. So we just want to have everybody trying different things, doing stuff beyond what they're doing right now, I guess.
Well, the breadth of things that libraries get involved with is just incredible to me. So thank you, Shanna. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Z, we've been hearing what the children's librarian is doing in Nevada. And I know you have some very unusual things that you're doing. What do you do with NASA?
NASA, my library program, was something that we started. Well, we didn't start. We were awarded, as you mentioned, we were one out of 78, maybe 75 in the nation to get it in 2017. And it has just really opened up opportunity, not only with space, but just opportunity to reach our patrons, those that, you know, have always come to the library and those, you know, who may have never come to the library but love NASA. And so with this program, we've been able to we've been able to interact with folks from the Marshall Space Center. We've done stuff with drones. I've been certified to handle lunar and meteorites. So I can bring stuff like moon rocks to the library. We've done that. We've worked with NASA Space Ambassadors to provide programming. Our library was a beta test site for a new virtual reality program with NASA. But the other cool thing with this program is it really has enriched our partnership. I think that's a foundation for all of us on here is partnerships with our community and those around the state and even around the nation. So Iowa State University Extension and Outreach and the Engineering Department, for example, have been awesome and wonderful to work with for the NASA program. So we're continuing that into the end of this year, but never fear because NASA will not go away in my world. So we will continue it somehow. So,
what actually got this whole idea for doing this program started was when I read about a program that you were doing with military families. I never quite understood how that could work. You said it was usually only on military libraries on military bases. So what was that?
So last fall, as librarians do, our brains never shut off. And we're always observing, or we're always thinking and moving forward on how we can continue to expand our services. In Boone, we have a National Guard, and we have always and will continue to serve military families. But, you know, it's always nice to see if there are services that are specific to those families. And so in doing my research, I found a program that's a national non-for-profit called United Through Reading. And it's a really simple, but such a great impact of a program. And what it does is it works with military servicemen and women, veterans, their families, to provide a connection opportunity through story time. And the way that that happens is they can download an app, the service men and women, their families for that matter. And once they download that, they'll need their troop ID to sign in. And then they just record a story time. And then once that story time is done, they can upload it and then send it off to their families. Now, the cool thing about this program is obviously they can do it when they're at a base or at, you know, at home in the States, but it's global. So they could do it wherever they're stationed. Now, as you mentioned, this program is something that when I reached out, but they had not worked with the civilian library before. And I have a mantra, and that is go big or go home. So I said, well, I want to be the civilian library that you work with to start. So we started it a couple months ago in terms of really initiating it. And I participated in a deployment event a few weeks back. And so we're just trying to, the military is just so vast and so large and really trying to get the message out there as to what the library's role is and then really helping all branches of the military utilize this program and get the word out. So, so far so good. United Through Reading has just been awesome. They provided a lot of resources at no cost for us to use. So,
Okay. Is there anything else we should know about the Erickson Public Library?
I mean, I think both Ashana and Colleen spoke truthfully just about libraries in general, and I would like to echo what they've said. I mean, we work tirelessly for our communities. Like I said, partnerships are a big thing. We're always focused on patrons, and we're always focusing on the needs and, you know, what we currently offer, and then how can we expand that? What new stuff are available? Yes, we all have budgets that we are provided, but with what we're given, I think we do an outstanding job. And COVID-19 has really proven a staple to the community and part of that investment piece. So that's all I would like to add.
I was so impressed when I came to Iowa and discovered that every town, no matter how small, has a library. And how that is, whether it was mandated they had to have a library, I understand that in the like 38, they were mandated they had to tax for a library. But I know that, for example, that in Story City, you have to partner with Gilbert. What's their situation in Gilbert?
Well, Gilbert is our branch, is a branch library of ours, and it is supported by the taxpayers in Gilbert. But we started a branch there 9 years ago. They had previously had services provided by the bookmobile from Ames, and they came to me and asked me if we would consider doing some library services. They were on contract with Ames when they suggested that maybe we could contract. We looked at what we could do for what they were offering financially. It's a good partnership. We share staff, we share books, we share all of our materials, we share programming. In fact, our story time that we're doing on through Zoom is being held out of the Gilbert Library. Our youth services librarian works in both Story City and in Gilbert. And so when we back each other up, and it's been a good relationship so far. We're, like I said, we're in our ninth year, and we're just getting ready to start our 10th. Obviously, with all of the impact from COVID-19, we looked at our budgets and tried to see where we could cut, make some cuts to try to help in the coming year because the tax bases are going to be impacted, and we understand that. But what they have access to everything, Bridges, in fact, consortium, until we tied in the year that we got the contract with Gilbert, because that helped us share our resources a lot. And so it's kind of, and that's kind of a per capita decision. Most libraries are funded based on a per capita basis. Some libraries are funded at a capacity, like the Ames Public Library is probably one of the highest funded per capita in the state of Iowa. Of course, Jenna and Zach, their libraries are all at different levels than we are. But we all offer pretty much the same level of services. And with like Maria Hart, who is our youth services librarian in Gilbert and also manages that operation there, she's instead of this year, we're trying to figure out how to do story times and events that we had already scheduled. And she decided to put together everything in one pack at the beginning. So once somebody comes to the library, whether it's in Gilbert or in Story City, they can pick up their summer library program materials and give them some STEM kits, some activity kits in there. There's some a book in there. There's a reading log. There's all kinds of, and their incentives are all in place. It's always a challenge to do an interesting summer reading program. And this year it got really interesting. We had to scrap almost all of our planning. I'm sure, Zach, you did the same thing. You had to scrap a lot of our programs. We're hoping by the end of summer, we're at least going to be able to do a couple of programs in the park, do some things where it's outside and people can sit together as family units. But we don't even know if we can do that yet. We're just starting that negotiation. But we have all had to get very creative about how do we engage our young people. We're so locked down right now. And I really feel for the parents and the children that are used to being able to come in the library independently and at any time they felt like it. Now they have to plan and call ahead and get online and try to find books. Yeah. But we're all only a phone call away. And I can tell you right now, I've worked with Zach a lot. I know Shannon real well. If you make a phone call to your local library, they will help you figure out how to get services right now and whatever it takes.
I feel like we ought to end there. But one thing I have thought about with the lockdown is how many programs like the after school program and a meeting places that the library provides that are not necessarily book centered. It's a community center as well as a place to get books and materials and learning things to learn. They also have wonderful spaces. And of course, people can't be in those spaces now. Of course, there isn't any after school program if there isn't any after school.
Eventually, I hope so. Zach?
That's a great question. And we're thinking, I think it's almost day by day what our future holds. My program specialist with teens and I were talking and, you know, we're prepared on, you know, probably to be doing virtual programming for quite some time. I guess I'm going to just see what the schools do. It might impact how we do outreach at the schools. I mean, during the school year, we go, I'm sure plenty of people go to our schools to provide outreach services, but it's really going to be dependent upon what their policies will be and if they are going to allow outside folks into the school. Trying to plan, but it's kind of hard to plan for that. Everybody wants people back and we want to go back to what was, but unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen anytime.
Thank you so much for being with us today, all of you. In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Susan Franzen, your host for this part of the program. This is a special COVID-19 program on local Iowa libraries, how they've helped us get through the isolation of lockdown and how they'll start limited opening during June and the rest of the summer. We have librarians from three libraries in our listening area, Colleen Taylor of the Bertha Bartlett Library in Story City, Shanna Spear of the Nevada Public Library, and Zach Bayer of the Erickson Public Library in Boone. Thank you. This is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard about some of the remarkable services available to us through our public libraries. We're turning now to another treasure of Iowa, our state parks. We have with us Steve Lekwa, Story County Conservation Board Director for many years, and known to newcomers for his nature columns in several weekly papers in the area. It was one of those columns that alerted me to the fact that 2020 is the 100th anniversary of the Iowa State Parks. And there is a newly published book on that very topic. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
I will let you introduce your guest, Mark Ackleson, who is also in our room. Hi, Mark. And you do the introductions.
I would love to introduce Mark. Mark and I started our conservation careers together back in 1973 here in Story County. Mark went on to work with the planning department at the DNR and later became president of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, a private organization, private foundation that's been instrumental in many county and state park programs, as well as other things throughout the state, including many right here in Story County. So good to see you there, Mark.
Good morning again, Steve.
I always like to tie our programs together, so I'll just have to mention that our last program was about the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway and the James H. Andrew Museum. And so we had Mike Wendell on, and we're talking about how the railroad beds were perfect for bike paths. And I noticed that Mark has been responsible for a number of bike paths. Is that right, Mark?
Yes, it's one of the ways that parks and getting people outdoors, especially during the COVID, have been helpful to people and able to convert previous railroad corridors into parks and nature trails. And boy, the use has just skyrocketed during our pandemic. And it's so wonderful to be able to see small groups and families, especially families. And I love seeing mom and dad pushing baby buggies and little kids on bikes. And it connects our communities together.
You say connect communities. Can you go from one state park to another by bike trails?
There are some places where communities are hooked by trails to their local state and county parks. But sadly, we can't link all the state parks because they're scattered in most of the state, but many of them are connected by trail now. And trails are one of the great success stories in Iowa. We're one of the leaders in the nation in the miles and numbers of trails. And we always sort of refer to them as bike trails, but they're way much more than that. In fact, if you really go out there on any day, they're more walkers than bikers, and the diversity and demographics are amazing.
Joggers, cross-country skiers, the paved ones, inline roller skaters, skateboarders, depending on the season here in Story County, you might run into the Iowa State University cross-country team out on one of our yeah. rural trails working out. So yes, all of the above.
Well, of course, we're really here for your anniversary edition, and I believe we were talking before the program a couple days ago about which were the first parks, the 1920 parks, and how were they chosen? What got it started?
Well, I think before we talk about which was the first or the second, just a brief bit of background. Of course, Iowa wasn't really open to settlement until the mid-1800s. But things happened fast after that. By 1900, Iowa had seen the most wholesale ecological change that perhaps the world has ever seen. We went from 37 plus million acres of prairie and forest and wetlands, and within a brief 50 years, barely a million acres of that was left in anything like its native condition. Virtually all of the prairies were plowed under, forests were cut down, towns were built, initially at least, as those things were building. There weren't even railroads, so the fuel to heat and to cook and to build things out of all came from Iowa's forests. It took an acre of woodland oak to build 1 mile of railroad. And almost every community had a railroad spur to it. Those green oak ties had to be replaced in less than 10 years because they were laid on just mineral earth grade. They didn't have Wyoming granite ballast underneath. So then they'd have to go back and cut another acre for each mile. So Iowa was just radically changed. Our wildlife disappeared. And by 1900, a group of people had already been studying some of those special areas that were either too rough, too wet, to be turned into farmland or towns or pastures, and were studying them and saying, these are special places. We don't want to lose them. Places like Backbone State Park, which became our first state park, were already well known and visited by university professors and by local people alike. The ledges that you and I talked about, Susan, very similar. Lots of people went there because it was still relatively pristine, and people were ready and anxious to save what little was left of native Iowa, both historically and ecologically at that time. So I should probably turn it over to Mark here because he has a much better handle on some of the progression of things that took place from, we'll say, around 1900 or just before, and moving up to about 1920, where we see the first state park dedicated.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. So there is a rich history. Iowa was one of the first state park systems in the country, and it was because of local communities and university professors, botanists like Thomas McBride and Pamel, and later women like Ada Hayden and Margot Frankel. So it was a broad spread recognition that we need to protect special places. And then they became more, they started kind of with a conservation perspective, as Steve said, but it then morphed into, boy, people really love those places, especially when the Model T Ford became available to people and people could get out. Suddenly the use has skyrocketed. So what really made our system successful were those early, early leaders, and even the 1917 legislation in Iowa that created the ability to do these things. But all across our system, and this is, I'm so glad to hear and see the people from the libraries. That's all tied together, including the book. We hope they have the book as well. But the Civilian Conservation Corps. So remember, we went through a depression, really bad depression in the 30s. And one of the ways we helped people was a Civilian Conservation Corps that in Iowa, at one time in total, had about 46,000 men working in 46 different camps across the state. And what they did was they planted trees to control soil erosion from much of the land that had been put to other uses. They built these incredible structures in our state park systems that many are still there today, and a lot of them have been restored. So we could go year by year by year, but I think the main message, as Steve has said, is that as like trails, they connect communities, and communities and local citizens have been the real drivers of conservation in our park systems at the state and, by the way, national level.
That topic, Susan, has come up time and time again. Those first state parks, well, in virtually all of that 1920s and 30s, rapid expansion of parks was by and large locally driven. Another thing that I'll let Mark elaborate on a little more, Iowa was very forward thinking at that time. Not only did we know we needed to protect or preserve these areas, the governor appointed a Blue Ribbon Commission to do a study of Iowa and say, what do we need to do to make all this happen? Some names that were on that, Mark has already mentioned, but another one that's so important to Iowa, Aldo Leopold, was on that commission. That 1930, no, what year, Mark?
1933, there was a 25-year conservation plan done for Iowa.
Yeah, and that was key as well, because that plan meant that in today's parlance, we had shovel-ready projects already in the plan, ready to go. And we had local community support already, not only mentally, spiritually ready to go. They were putting their dollars up in the middle of the Depression. They were raising money to set aside, acquire, develop these parks all over Iowa, not just one or two places, but all over. And FDR at one point told Congress, give Iowa whatever they need. They're ready to go. We were a leader, not just in state parks, but that 1933 plan also called for what became our county conservation system, something that's also unique in all of the nation. It was called for then. It took another 20 years plus for it to actually become reality. But Iowa was a leader in the whole movement toward parks. Many of the other states followed the Iowa plan to create their parks.
Well, I don't think that most people know that. I didn't know it. I just knew a few parks. And what surprised me in recent years was the new areas. They're small, you know, like a pond or a marsh that that was being set aside.
Mm-hmm. In the state parks, by design, you know, backbone ledges, they were regional jewels, places that people knew about and had visited since the late 1800s, at least, and were widely recognized and known. But there were many smaller areas, like you mentioned, that even today are still being captured, as it were, or protected and restored. Some of them 40 acres here for a wetland surrounded by corn and bean fields. Some of them, like the Skunk River Greenbelt between Ames and Story City, acquired piece by piece by piece over the years. Some pieces as small as 2 or 3 acres. And the counties stepped in for some of those smaller tracts to protect or manage, where the state managed the larger ones. And of course, the counties even managed some of the state parks.
I realize that this has been so interesting that we have forgotten to talk about the book.
There it is.
Yes.
Here it is.
But we'll put that up on our website anyhow.
Okay, we'll do that. Well, thank you for hosting this program, and the relationship to libraries is important. And I hope you libraries have your copies. I know I have bought one to give to my public library, and I know others are going to do the same because your budgets are limited. So as a part of the centennial celebration, there was also a private foundation created to help work with the Department of Natural Resources and other agencies to help celebrate the centennial. And Backbone State Park was actually dedicated on May 28th, 1920. By the way, that original dedication had been planned a year earlier, but it got flooded because of all the changes in the landscape. Anyway, so there are a lot of activities going on, and I will, Susan, I will give you some computer links that you can share with some of your readers and so forth, but I'll mention a few of them. So one of the things the Iowa Parks Foundation did was we have a centennial celebration committee. There are just four of us. Almost all have been related professionally and personally with our state and county and local park and conservation systems. So the book is called Iowa State Parks, A Century of Stewardship. And it really has been, as Steve described it, a century of stewardship. So this book is, first of all, let me say it's available now that the bookstores are back open. And the publisher was Iowa Park Foundation in partnership with the University of Iowa Press. And then we had a great team of editors and photographers. We had three of the best co-editors you could put together, Rebecca Conard and then Jim Scheffler and Angela Corio. But there were five essayists. There were 38 photographers. So the book is 228 pages. There are 222 beautiful color photographs, many of them two-page spreads. And then there's a great collection of a lot of these historic images, including some of the original plans for some of the parks that Steve talked about. So preparation for the Survey and Conservation Corps. So the book features 72 parks and recreation areas. As Steve said, about 14 of those are managed by county conservation boards. We actually have one state park that's managed by a township in Johnston. And then we have one that is managed by a municipality. Again, so it shows that strength of locals. So you can get the book not only at a bookstore, but University of Iowa Press. You can just go to their website, essentially, which is uipress.uiowa@edu, and boom, you can get in and order the book, and we can give that again later. So it's uipress.uiowa.edu. So the other feature that ties all this also together is the State Tourism and Department of Natural Resources have just released a passport to state parks. So just like the book is the reference of each park, preserve, and state forest, the passport now gives you kind of a, just like a travel pass, it is a travel passport to visit all the state parks in the system. So you can see how this is all tied together. In fact, Susan, I would ask you and even the librarians that are still online, Steve and I go through this all the time, like, so what's your favorite park, Susan? You talked about Ledges.
Well, that's the one I've always gone to. And it's, I remember the first time I approached it, you know, we were going through a cornfield and I thought, there can't be anything out here.
and then you
go down the hill and there it is. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I think as Steve and I, we've been, like Steve said, we've been friends for a long, long time. We've done a lot of traveling together and visited a lot of places. And we all have a favorite state park. And I would guess your librarians have a favorite state park. In fact, where you're at, there are some nice state parks. So I would urge, you can also get information on the book. And the state parks and the centennial celebrations in a couple places, I would add. So DNR puts out a magazine called Iowa Outdoors. Many of the libraries, I know my local library has it. And there's a feature, a recent feature in the summer issue that is devoted to the centennial state parks. There it is. See? All your listeners can see it because Steve's holding it up. And it's stunning in the historic photographs that are in it and just the detail that the state went through. I would also show you how comprehensive this is. Again, your readers, your listeners can see that the new Iowa transportation map in Iowa is dedicated to the centennial. So you can go to the rest stop or your county courthouse and get those. Another feature that we touched on and is touched on in the book, first of all, this book is gotten rave reviews, and we could just sit and talk about this book page by page, and it's organized in a way that you can follow it the way you want. So it starts with this broad overview of the history of parks, like we've talked about a little bit. It talks about the ecology. It talks about the architecture and landscape architecture, the geology, all of those things. And then it goes park by park in alphabetical order. So you can find the park that you want to know more about or preserve or state forest. Again, they're all here. So it's not only a guidebook and a reference book, but it is designed to be kind of a coffee table edition and widely used at your library as well. We talked about the Civilian Conservation Corps because I want to come back to that because it was so important to our state park system. And it was how our country responded to this economic crisis. And we're, you know, it's a different era and the response now has been different, but there are some similarities. I must confess, I've grown even a stronger interest to the Civilian Conservation Corps. As I've been doing some genealogy work, I found out my dad had been a CCC person in the mid to late 30s. And he had been stationed in Milford at Lake Okoboji State Park. And he had been stationed in Solon at Lake McBride State Park. And I remember him talking about planting trees and doing erosion control. And they even built dams. Some of the park state park dams were built by hand again because there was so little employment. So it's a part of our rich history. And again, that's all in the book as well. So I hope your listeners will contact your library, one, and see if they have it. If they don't, then maybe you could buy one.
It's wonderful to know that this is widely available. And I have a note from Colleen Taylor, who tells us that the map, the state maps, are available at the Bertha Bartlett Library. So
I would expect no less, Colleen, from your library.
So, well, thank you so much. This has been a very wonderfully informative program, and I hope that you are able to, I hope everyone's able to get out to the parks and into the library. Thank you very much.
And thank you, libraries, for what you've been doing. And Steve, good to see you again.
Thank you. Yep. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you, Susan.
Well, thanks to all of you. And I want to just take a minute to make an announcement.
June 20th, 2020 is the date set for the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival. In 1968, Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., and many others called for a revolution of values in America. They sought to build a broad fusion movement that could unite poor and impacted communities across the country. Their name was a direct cry from the underside of history, the Poor People's Campaign. Today, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has picked up this unfinished work. From Alaska to Arkansas, the Bronx to the border, people are coming together to confront the interlocking evils of systemic racism and poverty, ecological devastation, militarism, and the war economy, and the distorted moral narratives of religious nationalism. We understand that as a nation, we are at a critical juncture, that we need a movement that will shift the moral narrative, impact policies and elections at every level of government, and build lasting power for poor and impacted people.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa.
I've been your host today, Susan Franzen, together with Mike Murphy. Other voices you heard were Colleen Taylor, Shauna Spear, Zach Sear, Steve Lekwa, Mark Ackleson. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, the Ames Public Library will present a special reading program. And you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was St. Elmo's Fire. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you on the radio.